It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Kevin Gavin, filling in for Paul Guggenheimer. Following a three-month investigation, a grand jury decided not to charge a white Ferguson, Missouri police officer, Darren Wilson, in the August 9th shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown. St. Louis County prosecuting attorney Bob McCullough announced the decision last night that there would be no indictment. Demonstrations ensued, fires, arrests overnight. Joining us now is St. Louis Public Radio reporter Rachel Lippman, who covered the news conference last night. Rachel Lippman, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you.
Rachel, let's start with an update. What's happening right now in Ferguson? Is it calming down at all?
In the daylight, Ferguson has been calm so far. There is a block of a main commercial drag west Florissant that is blocked off by police. It is considered a crime scene because of the amount of looting and fires that occurred last night. I know there are protests in other areas of the city. One was planned for Clayton, Missouri, where the press conference took place last night. There's another one planned for downtown St. Louis today at noon, Central Time as well.
Rachel, have the protests from last night throughout the night been worse than those immediately following the shooting death of Michael Brown?
St. Louis County Police Chief John Belmar said last night or early this morning at a press conference that it was worse than he had seen during anything in the early days of August. It's important to note that there was a peaceful protest last night in an area of South St. Louis City, but there were a lot more fires and a lot more gunshots last night. Chief Belmar said last night he heard as many as 150 gunshots. Some of those were from automatic weapons. He said it was too dangerous for the firefighters to get in to battle some of the blazes. So many of the buildings that were burned last night did burn to the ground.
Too dangerous? Was it also too crowded? Was there any sense of miscommunication about where protesters could protest, that they were actually blocking streets and that, I understand, blocked firefighters from getting to responding to those fires?
I don't know if it was a miscommunication. Unlike the last time, there was, unlike in August, there was never any, quote, designated protest zone. So the protesters were going to be out kind of where everyone expected and predicted they would be, in the hot spots that have been sort of protest zones since August 9th when the shooting took place.
So let's get to what the prosecuting attorney said last night in making his announcement. He said the grand jury heard about 70 hours of testimony from about 60 witnesses. Mr. McCullough made it a point several times to say the grand jury were the only citizens that heard and saw all the evidence. He said there were inconsistencies and erroneous accounts from witnesses, but he never indicated any inconsistencies in Officer Wilson's account. Is that correct?
He's not specifically say if Officer Wilson had any inconsistencies in his statement from what he had told either the investigators on the scene or then when he came to speak to the grand jury. That is correct. He said that witnesses had inconsistencies within their own statements or statements that were inconsistent with the physical evidence.
Now, do we know either from the news conference itself or from the transcripts of the testimony whether Officer Wilson was asked why he pulled the gun, why not a nightstick, or just even pull away in his car and then sort of regroup to make an arrest?
In the transcript that I have seen, I did not get a chance to review Officer Wilson's testimony yet. Other colleagues have. My guess is that probably would have been a question that was raised, since self-defense and using force to effect an arrest would have determined or helped determine whether or not charges were filed.
Now, the prosecuting attorney did not mention, as far as I can remember, in the news conference, that Michael Brown was unarmed. Do we know if Officer Wilson was pressed on that aspect?
There's never been any dispute that Michael Brown was unarmed. There's never been anyone who said, I thought I saw a gun, or that it looked like he was carrying a gun. From the beginning, they have said that, from investigators have said that Michael Brown was unarmed.
Okay, so what's next in Ferguson for the community, for Michael Brown's family?
It's hard to say. There is a Ferguson commission that has been appointed by Governor Jay Nixon of Missouri to look at some of the systemic problems that Michael Brown's shooting in August unveiled. There is a parallel federal investigation going on as well into whether Officer Wilson violated Michael Brown's civil rights. That investigation is still ongoing, but legal experts have said that's a pretty hard, pretty high bar to clear. There may be a wrongful death lawsuit filed against Darren Wilson by Michael Brown's family. We don't know that for sure yet.
Rachel Lippman is a reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Rachel, thanks so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Kevin.
We've been talking about the grand jury's decision not to indict Officer Darren Wilson for the shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown. University of Pittsburgh law professor David Harris joins us in Studio A now to talk about the grand jury process. If you have a question for our guests or comment, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Or tweet at ESSPGH. David Harris, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Good to be with you, Kevin.
All right. So why was a grand jury used in this particular case when the DA could have done his own investigation and decided whether to file or not file charges?
Well, there are at least three alternatives. There was the grand jury. The DA could have done a preliminary hearing, an open court hearing, in order to decide whether there was probable cause. And the DA could have done his own investigation, as you say, and used what's called an information, a sworn statement of charges. The prosecutor used the grand jury because it allowed him to get an investigation going, to put it in front of members of the community, and then to absolve himself of personal responsibility for making the decision. That, in my mind, was the most troubling thing here. You saw lots of ways in which the grand jury was used unusually in a very uncharacteristic way. Usually, DAs control the grand jury. They decide what witnesses they did. They put only some of the evidence on. They control it. Here, the prosecutor said, well, I'm going to give them everything. I'm not going to recommend anything. They're going to make the decision themselves. This was a way of throwing it back so he got no responsibility for it and making it so hard for the grand jurors that this conclusion was not that surprising.
The second option you mentioned, so that open hearing held by the DA, is that sort of the equivalent of what we've had here in the past, a coroner's inquest kind of thing?
No, this wouldn't be a coroner's inquest. It is part of the trial process called a preliminary hearing. You go in front of a judge. The only question, just as in the grand jury, is whether or not there is probable cause to go forward with the case. In contrast to the grand jury.
But that's before somebody's even charged, whereas a preliminary hearing, somebody's already charged.
No. Well, they're preliminarily charged,
okay. Right.
But it does the same thing in terms of deciding whether to issue an indictment or not, go forward with the case or not. So it serves the same function as a grand jury hearing.
Okay. Now, we've heard criticism of the prosecuting attorney that he abdicated his authority. Quote, I've heard the term, he punted to send it to the grand jury.
Yes.
So it's like, okay, they decided.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't my decision.
Yes.
What do you think?
I think he did abdicate his responsibility, and I think he did so purposely. He was, as you remember, called out early on because maybe he or his office was unsuitable to do the investigation. There was some feeling about that in the community because his father had been killed. He was a police officer killed by a black man many years ago. He says, no, he's going to go forward. He's going to do it fairly and as openly as the grand jury allows. As I said, grand juries are almost always completely controlled by the prosecution. When that doesn't happen, when you have somebody saying, well, it's just up to them, here's all the evidence, you know you have something odd going on there. And that different way of proceeding was a way for him to get political cover, to say it's not, you know, it's their decision, not mine, and at the same time bring about the same result he may have wanted, which is no indictment. He simply flooded the grand jury with all of the information, which is highly unusual, made no recommendation to them about what they should indict.
That was a question at the news conference. Did you make a recommendation? And I did not hear an answer.
He did not give one. He said they drafted five indictments or five papers.
But didn't make
like
a recommendation.
But no recommendation. And that is highly unusual. So when you hear somebody giving those kind of explanations, I think it just gives rise to a kind of suspicion. People say, hey, the process isn't working like it usually is. Something is different. Something is not fair.
If you have a question or a comment for David Harris, the number to call is 412-246-2002 or tweet us at ESSPGH. David, this counsel raised the question again, and it happens often, when you have local prosecutors who have to work on a daily basis with
Absolutely.
Local police
mm-hmm.
investigating local police. Is there a conflict of interest, or at least the perception of a conflict of interest? You don't want to agitate somebody you have to work with, but you don't want to be perceived as sort of, you know, glossing over something that might have happened.
Oh, it's a real problem. It's a real problem, Kevin. You know, this comes up pretty much everywhere in the United States because our prosecutors in every county tend to be elected officials. And they have to work with the police every day, day in and day out. The police are their partners in the whole process. So one would think that there's a natural human inclination to see things their way, or maybe to go soft on them. I won't say that prosecutors always do that. Hardly the case. We've had prosecutions of police here in Allegheny County in the past. But what would be better is if there was a separate institution.
Can a state attorney general sort of assume the case or be given the case?
Sometimes. It depends on the state and how that state attorney general's office is structured. Sometimes they don't have any criminal jurisdiction. On this very question, I was exploring this, and I found that Wisconsin had recently passed a law that said that there had to be an independent investigation in police-involved shootings. I asked the Milwaukee prosecutor about that this past week when I was in a conference with him. He said it was a half measure and it doesn't really work. I discovered that in Canada, in Ontario, there is a unit, a dedicated unit that comes into any city, town when there is a crisis like this and does the investigation independently and decides on the charges. So there are structures that can be created, but it would be much different than the usual that we see here.
Back to the process itself that transpired in the Ferguson area. And that is how, since the officer testified, how aggressive can the presenting attorneys be? Can they, in a sense, cross-examine him to try to poke holes in his case? Or are they just allowing him to tell his story?
Well, we'll have to read the testimony, and I have not done that. But they could have taken either tack. All right. So if they simply allowed him to tell his story, just allowed him to present it without pushing or looking for inconsistencies or cross-examining, that would simply be a sign that they were just allowing it to happen without any interference from them. Because the cross-examination sort of technique for questioning witnesses is allowed in the grand jury. The prosecution, the only lawyers there. The defense lawyers are not there. So it would be perfectly legitimate for them to question, push, poke holes, things like that. And it'll be interesting to see if they did that or not.
I think some of the things we want to know is, why didn't you reach for a nightstick? Don't you have to unloop your gun to get at it? Why didn't you just pull away, start the car if it wasn't motor running, and just pull away and regroup?
Right. Well, I hope that some of the grand jury material that was released last night will answer some of those questions. There's a lot of it from what I hear, and it'll be a while before it gets sorted through. But always remember that police are trained. All police everywhere are trained that when they face a deadly threat, they are to respond with deadly force, not non-deadly force. So the question is, would it have been reasonable for Officer Wilson in these particular circumstances to feel he was under a deadly threat? And obviously the grand jury thought, yes, it is reasonable.
Okay, we have a caller on the line for a question for you. David, Dale in Northside, please go ahead.
My question is, do grand juries vote? And if they do, will we ever know who voted what? And what happens if they're tied?
That's a great question. They do vote. Because they have to vote on whether or not they want the indictment to issue. My understanding is that in most states, it requires an anonymous yes vote. I'm sorry, unanimous yes vote. And so if there was a tie, the answer would be no.
And the attorney, Mr. McCullough, said we had heard that it has to be at least 9 to file charges,
That's right.
12. But he wouldn't give a vote total. He said, basically said, I don't know.
Right. In Missouri, their rule is 9 of 12. Other states have larger grand juries, as many as 23. So these things vary by state. But he is never, and I doubt that the material released will ever tell us who voted what and, you know, what their names were or anything like that. I just don't think you'll see that.
All right. David Harris, University of Pittsburgh law professor, is joining us on Essential Pittsburgh. We'll talk more with David and also get community reaction here in the Pittsburgh area when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA.